I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, firing back. China hits the United States with retaliatory measures in response to President Trump's tariffs. We have the latest. Crucial decision. RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard face critical votes on their confirmations to President Trump's cabinet. And protecting the future. Pope Francis hosts an international summit on children's rights. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, President Donald Trump sparks a potential trade war with China, but so far both sides are limiting their response. The other tariffs facing Canada and Mexico were put on hold after last-minute negotiations, and now we are waiting to see how the U.S. and China will move forward. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
The White House says it focused on China because it did not do enough over the last 4 years to stop deadly drugs from entering the U.S. Analysts say China should curtail its response so it does not upset its own fragile economy.
China retaliates against U.S. tariffs. The communist country plans to implement a 15% tariff on coal and liquefied natural gas and a 10% tariff on crude oil, agricultural machinery, and large engine cars. The tariffs targeting U.S. imports kick in Monday unless President Donald Trump can strike a deal.
He is not going to allow China to continue to source and distribute deadly fentanyl into our country. That was the reason for this tariff.
The impact on U.S. exports may be limited. The U.S. does not send much LNG to China and exported less than 110,000 vehicles to China.
China has long been preparing for less exposure to the U.S.
China also opened an antitrust investigation into Google. It's unclear how the probe will affect Google's operations.
When we talk about tariffs, they're usually used to protect domestic industries or bring back manufacturing, in this case, back to U.S. soil.
While tariff battles play out, the president of the Lantos Foundation for Human Rights and Justice, who I spoke with at the International Religious Freedom Summit today, suggested another reason for President Trump to use them.
But I think it might be kind of a breakthrough for the Trump administration to think about using tariffs as a tool to win concessions on religious freedom. We see it on trade, we see it on immigration. Maybe religious freedom needs to get in on that as well.
But it's doubtful tariffs could be used on China to punish it over its treatment of religious communities.
For a lot of reasons, China is more impervious to our efforts to pressure and to leverage power with them than many other countries.
President Trump also threatens future tariffs to level the playing field with Europe. The European Commission says it's prepared to talk to avoid a trade war. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, today, the FBI has handed over the names of more than 5,000 employees who helped in the January 6th Capitol riot investigations. The FBI had until today to submit the names to the Justice Department. Several employees filed a lawsuit to prevent the release of their information. They are worried the Trump administration wants anyone involved to be fired. Well, for the first time since taking office, President Trump is hosting a world leader at the White House. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived this afternoon to talk about several issues. First and foremost, the ongoing war with Hamas, currently under a ceasefire, but also important, the ever-present threat from Iran. This afternoon, the president signed a presidential memorandum making it harder for Iran to produce a nuclear weapon. Today, we spoke with former Ambassador Sam Brownback, who says Iran is ripe for regime change.
Iran is the funder, the organizer, and the weaponizer, and the group that supplies weapons to all those terrorist groups that you named. Without Iran, you don't have this problem in the Middle East. With that Iranian mullah leadership that's been in place for 45 years as a dictatorial power, you're going to continue to have it.
Brownback also said the Iranian government is not even popular among its own people. As for how the war in Gaza ends, Brownback says hopefully through a negotiated settlement and all hostages being released. All right, let's bring in Eli Saltzman, director of the Joseph and Alma Gittenhorn Institute for Israel Studies at the University of Maryland. Eli, great to be with you. So tell us, how important is this meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu? And what does it say to you that he is the first world leader that Trump is meeting with since his inauguration?
Good evening, Tracy. Well, first of all, it's a very, very significant and important meeting. In fact, it will be a meeting that probably will shape the future of the Middle East as the way we know it now. It will address a number of key issues, very significant, very important. One is the future of the Gaza Strip and the food and the move to the second stage of the hostage deal that was signed or agreed upon between Israel and Hamas. The second one is the future of the Iranian nuclear program, whether the United States is willing to put all options on the table, kind of an argument, and threaten the elimination of Iran's nuclear program. And lastly, it's about the normalization agreement between Israel and the Saudi kingdom. These are very, very heavy, very significant, very dramatic turning points. The fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is the first leader to visit President Donald Trump after he was reelected just recently signals that the Trump administration pays significant attention and is very much attentive to things that are happening in the Middle East now, specifically those that may spoil perhaps some of the president's long-term objectives in the region.
Eli, let's also talk about the next steps for Gaza. Do you think that's also on the table during this meeting between Netanyahu and President Trump?
Yes, absolutely. Going into the meeting, President Trump already made some comments that are extremely controversial. He argued that the Gazans will be better off relocated to some other countries, namely Egypt and Jordan, and he expects both countries to absorb them or to welcome them with open arms. They are extremely resistant to do so. They've been very resistant so far, especially the Egyptians who share a border with the Gaza Strip. Yes, absolutely, this is critical. On the other hand, the president also wants to move forward and transition to the second part of the deal, something that the Israeli prime minister is quite reluctant to do because that may endanger and jeopardize his political future back in Israel.
Yes, and let's talk a little bit more about this. I know this meeting is also crucial to him as he is facing some opposition within his own party and in Israel because of the ceasefire deal.
Yes, absolutely. One of his top partners in the coalition government, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, said that basically if Israel does not resume the fighting towards the total elimination of Hamas, he will bring down the government. He will bring an end to Benjamin Netanyahu's government. And the fact that there may be some elections in the horizon certainly makes Benjamin Netanyahu be more vulnerable and certainly more fearful. His prospects of regaining control of the parliament or becoming prime minister once again look very gloomy at the moment.
Well, Eli, so much more we can talk about, but unfortunately we are out of time. Thank you so much for your insights today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tracy. Have a good evening. Take care.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is carrying on with his trip through Latin America, making stops in El Salvador as well as Costa Rica. He responded today what he calls a generous offer from El Salvador's president to accept and jail violent American criminals.
That's an offer President Bukele made. Obviously, we'll have to study it on our end. There are obviously legalities involved. We have a constitution. We have all sorts of things. But it's a very generous offer. No one's ever made an offer like that.
Well, Rubio says the offer raises clear legal issues and President Trump will make a decision on whether to accept it. Rubio made the comments during his visit to Costa Rica, where he discussed immigration with the nation's president. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the controversial environmental lawyer turned public health critic, cleared his first hurdle in becoming the nation's top health official. Members on the Senate Finance Committee voted to advance his nomination for a Senate confirmation vote. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has the latest.
Good evening, Tracy. Republicans all voted to advance the nominee. Well, all Democrats opposed RFK Jr. All eyes were on Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who is also a physician. He opposed RFK's views about vaccines, but in the end voted for him. Later, Senator Cassidy spoke on the Senate floor saying, if confirmed, RFK promises to work together with him.
I will use my authority as chairman of the Senate Committee with Oversight of HHS to rebuff any attempt to remove the public's access to life-saving vaccines without ironclad, causational, scientific evidence that can be accepted and defended before the mainstream scientific community and before Congress.
Democrats continue to raise alarms about Kennedy's views on vaccine safety, his potential to profit off lawsuits over drug makers, and his abortion and right-to-life policies.
He refused to tell us whether he would blindly follow a directive from Donald Trump to break the law and end access to mifepristone. And he seemed to have no understanding of his role in enforcing existing federal laws that guarantee women the right to life-saving abortion care.
Another of President Trump's nominations also faced a committee test. Tulsi Gabbard's bid to become Director of National Intelligence was advanced to a full Senate by the Intelligence Committee. But the top Democrat on that committee says he doesn't trust her judgment.
It's flabbergasting to me that she couldn't even bring herself to call Edward Snowden a traitor, someone that I think all of us involved in the intelligence community feel is a traitor. And I don't know how she's going to run an intelligence committee, 18 different agencies, and say to the workforce, oh, now you got to adhere to the law because she's in charge.
But Republican Senator Susan Collins is now a yes on confirmation.
I questioned to her extensively about her views on Edward Snowden, and I am now satisfied that she will not seek in any way to have him pardoned.
Republican Senator Todd Young was also on the fence, but after several meetings, he said on X that he will support Tulsi Gabbard's nomination and look forward to working with her to protect our national security. Both nominees are expected to go before a full Senate vote sometime next week. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
And in other news, authorities are calling it the worst mass shooting in Swedish history after a gunman opened fire at an adult education center, killing around 10 people. The shooting occurred in the city of Örebro, about 125 miles west of Stockholm. Officials say the gunman is among those dead. And the damage at the crime scene is so extensive that investigators could not be more definitive on the total number of deaths. The local head of police says the investigation is ongoing and they believe the perpetrator acted alone. The school serves students who are over the age of 20. A teacher says many students had already gone home following a national exam. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including the fight for freedom. Learn more about a conference being held right in our nation's capital, focused on securing religious freedom around the world. And learn about a first-of-its-kind event on children held at the Vatican and why the Holy Father is calling on the faithful to love and protect them. Religious freedom is one of the central tenets of the United States and the Western world. But in many parts of the globe, men and women are imprisoned, beaten, or even killed simply for practicing their faith. That is why the International Religious Freedom Summit, held today and tomorrow in Washington, D.C., is raising awareness of the problems that many are facing across the globe. And joining us now to talk more about the fight for religious freedom is Lizzie Frances Brink with ADF International. Elizabeth, good to be with you. We appreciate it. I know you and your team are celebrating some great news out of Egypt regarding a father of five who was part of a private Christian Facebook group and was in prison. I understand he's now been released. Can you tell us more about him and that case?
With pleasure, yes. Abdul Baki Saeed Abdul is a man from Yemen who converted to Christianity. And on account of the safety of his life, he had to flee Yemen to Egypt. So when he went to Egypt, he was supporting other Christian converts like himself online. And he was also engaging in TV evangelism. But this was enough for the authorities to want to censor him because of his religious belief. They called him into the police station. He was interrogated. And then he was led to a detention cell where he was left for 3 years. He was left there as another child was born to his wife. He had very limited access to his family and also to his lawyer, who was applying every 90 days for him to be released, because this was a case of pre-trial detention. This was not a case that he had been convicted and was sentenced, but he was awaiting a criminal trial. He was left in detention under national security legislation. Allegedly, he was a risk to the national security in Egypt just because he was a Christian and he was expressing his beliefs. But we are super grateful for the Egyptian authorities that they released him after 3 years. And he is now in a place of safety. But of course, a lot has changed in those 3 years, but we're still rejoicing that he is now released.
Yeah, and sadly, I know this is not the only case that ADF International has worked on when it comes to people that are being persecuted simply for their faith. Talk to us more about that, and also maybe some of the countries that are of particular concern when it comes to religious freedom.
Yes, we're a team of lawyers at ADF International, and we work with allied lawyers on the ground in numerous countries. Across North Africa and the Middle East, there are many cases where Christians are imprisoned on account of their faith, whether they have converted to Christianity, whether they are engaging in evangelism, whether they are speaking in other forums about their faith. They face persecution. Across Africa as well, we work with lawyers in Nigeria. We have many cases in Nigeria where we're supporting Christians who are especially facing very difficult times for standing up for what they believe. Also in Asia, where Christians have converted and are speaking about their faith, there are numerous examples where we're working with local lawyers to ensure that everyone has a credible legal defense.
Yeah, and religious freedom is, of course, the focus of the International Religious Freedom Summit that we mentioned is taking place today and tomorrow right here in Washington, D.C. And I understand that you'll be taking part in a panel discussion. Tell us what you'll be discussing.
We're going to be looking at this in this panel discussion at the Religious Freedom Summit on the successes of the movement. The religious freedom movement has grown substantially over the last few years. And here in D.C., there are senior policymakers, politicians, NGOs from all around the world who are committed to religious freedom. So we're going to be looking at what does success look like, because we can talk about religious freedom in these forums, but ultimately religious freedom is about advocating for the individual and their rights to be able to live out their faith and their belief in the privacy of their own mind, out in public, within their family units. And so we're thinking about the individual and what we can do for him and her across the world. And that's the focus of the panel that I'll be speaking on tomorrow.
Well, Lizzie, thank you so much for coming on and to speaking with us about all this. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
Pope Francis and leaders from around the world have gathered at the Vatican this week for the first ever international summit on children's rights. The Holy Father highlighted the ongoing struggles faced by children across the globe and urged the world to listen to them and their cries. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Sitikin has more.
Nulla vale la vita di un bambino.
Nothing is worth more than the life of a child.
What is the cost of
this was the message of the first ever international summit on children's rights, hosted by the Vatican, entitled Love Them and Protect Them.
For convening this critical summit.
At the invitation of Pope Francis, world leaders gathered at the Vatican to address the global crisis of millions of children deprived of their basic human rights. In his address, the Pope specifically condemned the harm inflicted on children and society through abortion.
In the name of this throwaway mentality, in which the human being becomes all-powerful, unborn life is sacrificed through the murderous practice of abortion. Abortion suppresses the life of children and cuts off the source of hope for the whole of society.
Summit speakers included Queen Rania Al Abdullah of Jordan, former U.S. Vice President Al Gore, FIFA President Gianni Infantino, and Holocaust survivor Edith Brooke. Seven panels covered a range of topics on children's rights to resources, to education, to family, and to live free from violence. To address a child's right of food, nutrition, and health care, Magnus McFarlane Barrow was invited to the Vatican Summit. He is the CEO of the global charity Mary's Meals, an organization that feeds more than 2 million children worldwide.
It was wonderful to be able to speak in that room about what we do, which is a very simple intervention for children who are hungry and missing school, and to be able to highlight something very practical and simple that's working, and reminding people that, you know, if we don't start with the very basics, and first of all the right to life being the first thing, and beyond that, you know, if we're not ensuring children are fed and in school, if we don't start there, all those other things that we might desire for children don't make sense.
McFarlane Barrow explained that he has never seen so many famines and hunger crises worldwide, despite advances in resources and technology, and emphasized the urgency of action.
I think we are failing our children globally massively in all sorts of different ways. You know, we have an even greater responsibility for that failing because we have more possibilities than ever. We have more tools at our disposal than ever to solve these things and to uphold the rights of every child to life and for their growth and to enable them to flourish. We have so many ways we can do that today, and I think it's a very great failing. And that's why I was so pleased that the Holy Father would convene a meeting like that and take the lead on that.
At the end of the summit, Pope Francis and other speakers signed a declaration of 8 principles regarding the protection and care of the rights of children. The Holy Father also announced that he intends to make children the theme of a new apostolic exhortation to give continuity to this commitment and promote it throughout the Church. In Rome, Benedictia de Grien, EWTN News Nightly.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, thousands of people take to the streets in Ireland to celebrate St. Bridget's Day. Father Antonio Maria will tell us all about it.
I shall not be.
The body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ took to the streets in Northern Ireland in a special Eucharistic procession meant to inspire all to seek and find Christ. It happened on Sunday in the city of Derry. Participants say it's important that everyone sees their love for Christ.
Our religion isn't meant to be just private and to yourself. It's meant to be public, and to give this level of a public witness in front of thousands is going to change the world.
It's important that each of us are seeing the Lord in His glory, understanding who He actually is. And I think we can understand who Christ is by seeing how each other reflect in Him, how we gaze at the Lord, how we stare at His divine look, His love in the Eucharist.
And for more on the Eucharistic procession, we turn now to Father Antonio Maria Diaz de Medina for the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. Father, great to be with you today. So why did the CFR initiate this event?
We want to bring our Lord Jesus to people who no longer go to church, or those who are lost, or those who have no hope. There's a lot of darkness here. And so we know that when we lift Jesus high, then hearts are changed. And we know that His Eucharistic face is shining upon the land.
Yeah, it certainly is. Talk to us about St. Bridget and why you decided to do the procession on her feast day.
Yeah, well, St. Bridget, one of the friends on my core team was mentioning that there is a tendency nowadays to make her more of like a New Age saint, you know, and like or a goddess. And so part of it was to correct that. But also St. Bridget is one of the 3 main patrons of Ireland, along with St. Patrick and St. Columba. And according to the story, just the significance of her spreading her cloak over the land to claim it for Jesus Christ. So we wanted to reorient things towards our Lord.
Historically, how significant is it to have this event in Northern Ireland?
I think it's very significant. It's changes the spiritual atmosphere here. Just one friend here was telling me about her father and uncle had been here during a time of the Troubles. And she said that it was just the atmosphere for the people who were waiting for that, and the processions that have happened was more heavy and somber, while her experience of being at this procession, Eucharistic procession, was one of joy. And she could see men of her father's age who were teary-eyed, but they weren't sad. They were crying tears of joy. And so it's the Lord healing memories for the people here in Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Before I let you go, overall, your thoughts on the procession and what do you think it achieved?
I just give thanks to God for the great weather, the great team, the people. I believe it really lit a fire. And so it was just amazing. So it started off small. We're going to just keep it here. But then one of our team members suggested having a procession in Medjugorje. And so they said yes. So we had many places around the world where there's adoration or processions or people praying, interceding with and for us. And so something about with the Jubilee of Hope And this fire of the Lord coming to people through his Eucharistic presence, it's really done something. It's become a movement.
That's wonderful. Father, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of this with us. We really appreciate it. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.